topic for today is going to be nature and nurture, Judaism and environmentalism. And this is a topic which requires a lot of sensitivity, requires a lot of knowledge and awareness, both in terms of the facts on the grounds and in terms of also the reaction to those facts. So let's start with the following. In general, this is a general trend in human development. In human development, technology far overtakes the awareness of where that technological development reaches. Fair fact, the Industrial Revolution has been here for centuries. Industrialization, the urbanization, the use of greater tools in industry, and only recently are we becoming aware of the impact, the significance socially, globally, on the ecology as well of our actions. Here in our own Chicago, not more than a century ago, we were still dumping sewage into our own water supply to the degree that when the World's Fair came around, we had to pump in water from outside of Chicago. Just the lack of awareness of what technology does to our environment, our surrounding environment. So I'd like to just walk through with you five parts, five little sections today in this share. The share is broken up into, first of all, the existent threat. What really exists outside of us? How we react to that? How does the world react to that? Does religion have a part in that? As number two. And then three models. Three separate models, which just for your convenience, every page in the source book is one of these topics. The first double-sided page is the threat. The second double-sided page is reaction. And the last three, which are in color, are three separate models, each page being a separate model of the relationship of religion to this particular issue. So that's what we're setting out to achieve in this span of time. So first of all, we need to go back to 1962. It should have been much earlier than this. But 1962 was the year of publication of Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, for those of you who have read it. And in her eloquent way, Rachel Carson describes the effects on society, or the effects on nature, of DDT, of the use of pesticides. That's among the things she talks about, but the effects it has on society as a whole. And here, I put down within the first source on the first page, is actually part of the chapter one. Now, to be fair, this is a little demagoguery. So she's describing a scene over here, which she admits to herself is not something which particularly happened in one place, but just to give you a taste, the first paragraph. This is the first paragraph of her book. There was once a town in the heart of America where all life seemed to live in harmony with its surroundings. The town lay in the midst of a checkerboard of prosperous farms with fields of grain and hillsides of orchards, where in spring, white clouds of bloom drifted above the green fields. In autumn, oak and maple and birch set up a blaze of color that flamed and flickered across the black over backdrop of pines. Then foxes barked in the hills and deer silently crossed the fields, half hidden in the mists of the fall mornings. And she goes on to describe the beauty of this town, dropping down a full paragraph. Then a strange blight crept over this area, and everything began to change. Some evil spell had settled on the community. Mysterious maladies swept the flocks of chickens. The cattle and sheep sickened and died. Everywhere was a shadow of death. The farmers spoke of much illness among their families. In the town, the doctors had become more and more puzzled by the new kinds of sickness appearing among their patients. There had been several sudden and unexplained deaths, not only among adults, but even among children, who would be stricken suddenly while at play and die within a few hours. And she carries on to describe the terrible, how this paradise, this utopia, this beautiful town is turned into a valley of death. And the chickens laying eggs which never hatched. And she goes on to describe, and this is in the second to last paragraph on the right side, in the gutters under the eaves between the shingles of the roof, a white granular powder still showed in a few patches. Some weeks before it had fallen like snow upon roofs and lawns, the fields and streams. No witchcraft, no enemy action had silenced the rebirth of new life in the stricken world. The people had done it themselves. This town does not actually exist, but it might easily have 1,000 counterparts in America or elsewhere in the world. I know of no community that has experienced all the misfortunes I described, yet every one of these disasters has actually happened somewhere. and many real communities have suffered a substantial number of them. So on the one hand, this is not a particular case of a specific town, but an amalgamation of experiences across America as a result of the use, and what she pinpoints as one of the uses as her particular argument is against the federal use, in fact, at the time, of pesticide. And since, and somewhat owing to her great efforts, pesticide DDT is now officially illegal for use in America, although not globally. But this became one of the flagships. This is one of the seminal works in the environmental movement. But no, it didn't stop there. And across the globe, there is an awareness which today we may take for granted, but it was certainly not such just a few decades ago. Just taking us back already two decades, in 1992, the world scientists gave a warning to humanity. This group included 1,700 of the world's leading scientists, including a majority of Nobel laureates in sciences. And they proclaimed the following. I just summarized these are some paragraphs. This is not the entire message. That is an introduction. Human beings and the natural world on a collision course. Human activities inflict harsh and often irreversible damage to the environment and on critical resources. If not checked, many of our current practices put at serious risk the future which we wish for human society and the plant and animal kingdoms, and may so alter the living world that it will be unable to sustain life in the manner that we know. Fundamental changes are urgent if we are to avoid a collision, the collision our present course will bring about. That's the introductory paragraph, and they summarize individually different resources and how they're being impacted. Just to draw out two for a moment, just to be aware of what's going on in the 90s. Just in the 90s, this is already 20 years ago. In the water resources, helix exploitation of depletable groundwater supplies endangers food production and other essential human systems. Heavy demand on the world's surface waters have resulted in serious shortages in some 80 countries, containing 40% of the world's population. Pollution of rivers, lakes, and groundwater further limits the supply. Further in soils, perhaps, is very apropos. Loss of soil productivity, which is causing extensive land abandonment, is a widespread byproduct of current practices in agriculture and animal husbandry. Since 1945, 11% of the Earth's vegetated surface has been degraded. An area larger than India and China combined, and per capita food production in many parts of the world is decreasing. It doesn't take far. You can go, you can read on Scientific American, you can read on National Geographic the statistics of the degree of sustainability of the Earth at the current rates. And in fact, if we're taking it even closer to our time, in 1999, an experiment was conducted just to completely bombard ourselves with some of the statistics. This is an article in Scientific American written by Rachel Moller, or made Rachel Moller. This last paragraph on page 2, to assess the sustainability of past and present human activity, Mathis Wackernagel and his colleagues did two things. First, they quantified the annual amount of land and water resources needed to meet the human demand for food, shelter, and fuel, and among other things. Then they estimated the actual productivity of the Earth's land and oceans. When the researchers compared supply and demand, they found that in 1999, humanity consumed 120% of the Earth's sustainable or consistently replenishable resource capacity. In other words, the global population exhausted a supply of natural resources equivalent to that produced by 1.2 Earths each year, eroding nature's ability to regenerate. It seems that this trend will not soon level out. In 1961, the world used 70% of its sustainable productivity. Since the 1980s, it has consistently exceeded it. So there are books, there are volumes written about this, but just to be aware on all levels, in terms of first of all what humanity is doing to destroy the resources, but also in terms of overusing, there are two different issues being identified over here, sometimes blurred, right? The notion of overusing, the notion of destroying the resources that we have, and it's at a critical state. It really is at a critical state from the way that as we have it today. And notice that without even having to go into territory like global warming, still on a scientific debate, without even going there, just in terms of the water, air, soil resources that really affect us, and although we don't necessarily feel it as much, we're cushioned and we're lucky to be living in a first world country, the rest of the world is feeling it, and it does impact as the food prices rise at higher rates than inflation. So there is a serious ramifications. We've all seen in the last year the weather pattern effects, the unusual weather patterns, which a number of geologists draw attention to the fact that this is the Earth's response to some of the activities we've been doing on its surface. And with that in mind, just put a painting scene of what is actually going on. The question is as Jews, as people who seek to find truth, seek to live by truth, what does the Torah actually say about that? Does the Torah say anything about it? Is it a value? Is there a value to, against? Is it neutral? That's something that we should be thinking of in an era in which the world is thinking very much about sustainability and about environmentalism. So I'd like to draw your attention to an article which raised a lot of emotions. This was published in 1970 in the New York Times. This is on page 4. I'm not going to read the entire article, have no fear. But there's a few paragraphs which are essential. This is an article which was published in 1970, May 1st, and was the spark of a debate, a continued discussion. Rabbi Lam wrote an article in response to this particular New York Times article, because it indicates or it describes a conference which occurred in Claremont, California, which was called the Theology of Survival. And in this conference, there were a number of theologians, there were a number of scientists meeting about religion's part in sharing the burden of ecology. So it says, I'm quoting from the second paragraph where the arrow is. Among the values to come under attack were the right of couples to have large families, the need for constantly expanding economy, and sacredness of human life over against the rest of nature. The theologians, 20 in number, were participants in the 3-day conference on the theology of survival, which ended today in the School of Theology at Claremont. It was the first major symposium to be convened to consider the religious dimensions of the ecological issue. So what do you think? You stop there. So religion and scientists, they're usually at odds on other issues. What's religion's part in this? Very fascinating. It became very much a one-sided conference, if you can't carry on reading. Virtually all of the scholars agreed that the traditional Christian attitude toward nature had given sanction to the exploitation of the environment by science and technology, and thus contributed to air and water pollution, overpopulation, and other ecological threats. In other words, Christianity, based on the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, was blamed for sanctioning pollution, the mindset of pollution. Basic to this assertion is the commandment in Genesis 1:28, for man shall be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. As the Torah, the Bible, gives the right to humanity to do what it wants with that nature around them. In a well-known article in Science magazine, Lynn White Jr., professor of history in the University of California, at Los Angeles, argued that this idea, coupled with Judeo-Christian rejection of pagan beliefs in the divinity of nature, made it possible for Western society to exploit nature in a mood of indifference to the feelings of natural objects. And actually, interestingly enough, in that article in Science, the argument is made that should society return to its pantheism, the sacredness of all and the universalism, the sacredness of all life, then effectively we would find a solution for environmentalism. Because within the current climate of religious, of Judeo-Christian values, there was no place for ecology. And thus, in terms of who took the blame, the scientists point very much towards religion. And religion, actually, interestingly enough, in this article, accepts it. And very pompously, at the end of the article, Dr. Cobb, who's one of the participants, suggests that Christianity should start teaching about the sacredness of life. And he has an entire, it's almost a sermon, which he prescribes that the priests should start teaching about. And they accepted it, interestingly enough, though, at least the way it's conveyed in this article. Very interesting article. And one has to think, does Judaism have something to say about that? Is that the whole picture? Are they correct? But it does say we should subdue the earth, right? Boratius does say that. That's what they're quoting. So we need to put a few checks and balances in here. What was that?
We're supposed to take care of the world.
Fantastic. So the point is that before we even get into the models, but they are only quoting one pasuk. So it's going to be relevant in a moment. Things are wonderful when they're taken out of context because it makes it so much easier to make arguments. But it's important to gain a perspective, a wholesome perspective, in order to appreciate what Judaism really does say. Now, just to create a foil for what we're about to do, let's just turn back for a moment to page 3. And this is the perspective of Hillel Halkin, who wrote in 2007 in response to eco-Judaism. And he's responding to an article about how Judaism is a propagator of ecology. And he says in the second paragraph, "Why do I find this concept so silly? It's certainly not because I doubt the importance of environmental values if this planet is to remain livable. And it's certainly not because I think that Judaism, a religion which I grew up with, and am reasonably well-versed, even if I don't observe it very much today, shouldn't try to make itself relevant to contemporary problems. But there's a big difference between trying to make Judaism relevant to contemporary problems and trying to turn it into a reflection of contemporary attitudes. And it's the latter of these two activities that eco-Judaism is engaged in. As such, it's really not like many other kinds of modern Judaism before it, starting with the Reform movement in the 19th century in Germany, more of an eco-Judaism. I'd like to propose a simple test to determine if eco-Judaism is a natural outgrowth of Jewish theology and thought. Suppose you're not already an environmentalist. Would a knowledge of rabbinic Jewish texts and traditions turn you into one?" That's a great question. His answer is, the answer, of course, is no. The fact is that rabbinic Judaism traditionally has had very little to say about environmental problems, for the simple reason the Jews who have lived for the better part of their history in the diaspora, and the diaspora was never considered to them to be their true environment. The rabbis thought about many things, but the environment in the sense of the word it is used now used was never one of them. The argument of Hillel Halkin. Now, you really put yourself on the wire when you make this kind of argument, because if you claim that rabbinic Judaism doesn't talk about it, and so in Torah Judaism, that means to say you've looked at all the rabbinic Judaism and put the arguments together. That's a very dangerous claim to make if there are very many indications in the opposite direction. So, but I think his question is something which we should think about. In this conference, Theologies of Survival, Christianity and effectively Judaic Christian value is being attacked by science as being the sanction or the one that condones or sanctions the right to use without check the environment. How does religion respond? Is our response merely apologetic, as Hillel Halkin would like to suggest? Or are there axiomatic principles which actually show that there is a value here? There is a value at hand. That's the question which we have at hand, and which we have the next little while to think about together. Just to put all the facts together. So what I'd like to do with you today is I'd like to consider three models. Three simple models, and this is going to be each of the last three pages. Each a different color on the printing and the printed one. And we'll start with actually just picking up where the article left off with. The article accused Christianity, and in this case also Judaism, with giving the right to humanity to be able to use anything unsubdued, unchecked. And we need to investigate if that's really true. But before we even start that, I came across a very fascinating Rabbeinu Bechaya. And I think this is very instructive in terms of analyzing this issue. Rabbeinu Bechaya quotes a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, which says the following. Notav titofna sifsosayich kala. Your lips drip of sweetness. Dvash v'cholav tachas l'shonech. And you have honey and milk under your tongue. Says Rabbeinu Bechaya that there are many types of wisdom in the world. There's wisdom which is found in Torah. There's wisdom which is found outside of Torah. The difference is that the wisdom found out of Torah is the word noifes, sweetness. But non-naturally occurring sweetness has other elements in it. It's not pure. It has to be engineered. When it comes to dvash, honey, which he likens to the wisdom of the Torah, the Torah is pure. The Torah's wisdom is pure. When we analyze this, we need to look at the values of the society around us. Many of them are valuable. Many of them are valuable, but some parts of it are not as well. We're going to have to analyze, when comparing this and seeing what Judaism says about this, we need to also see, is everything that environmentalism argues in the current day and age also something we're willing to adopt under the flagship of what we're about to see? That should be just a framework just to be able to think about before we wholeheartedly accept or dismiss the claims made in environmentalism. The first model I'd like to draw your attention to is on the yellow page in our books, which is Instructions from Eden. Let's turn to that pasuk, which is Bereishis 1:28. This is in the first source on page 5. Hashem did tell us, Vayvarech osam nakim. God blessed them, them being Adam and Eve. Remember, they were created together, right? Vayomer lohem elokim, peru ruvu midos aretz. Multiply, and be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth. V'kiv shuha. Conquer it. It's a very strong word. Radu bidgas hayam, and rule over, have dominion over the fish in the sea, of hashamayim, the birds of the heaven, and you shall have power over everything, all the creeping things on the earth. Sounds if all you had is this, it would sound like this is a pretty one-sided picture. Humanity is the center of everything, and it is able to use and subdue everything it needs for its own service. Right? That's what it would sound like from this. The only thing you have to think about is that it wasn't really true. Could humanity eat animals yet at this point? They could not. When were they able to eat it?
Post-Noach.
Why post-Noach? Why was it chosen at that point in time that we only had given sanction at that point? Noach did take care of them. That is mentioned. But more poignantly is that before the flood, there was animalism. There was relationships between humanity and animals. God needed to draw that line a little clearer in order to be able to differentiate. So what happens? Hashem puts a barrier. But initially, how was it supposed to be? Were we allowed to eat them? No, not at all. We had the plant life to be able to sustain us. Just as to point out the absoluteness of this pasuk. But moreover, is the Torah itself says in the next parak. 16 psukim later, in source 2, Bereishis Beis Tezvov, Vayikach Elokim Hashem Elokim Es Adam, God placed man, we took man, Vayinicheo Began Eden, he placed him in the Garden of Eden to do what? La'avda u'lashama, I heard those words mentioned beforehand, is to work it and to guard it. So wait a second, this is unbridled usage? Not so clear. Sounds like humanity has the right, but within certain constraints. Do you see this? There's a tension right there in the two creation epics, in chapter 1 and chapter 2. There are two different missions given to man in relation to the world, to conquer it, but also to guard it. So in trying to untie this knot, many of the contemporary Mepharshim suggest very interesting balances, which I think are very relevant to what we're talking about today. The Malbim points out, and he'll say, but without going into it inside, in source 3, the Malbim suggests that our external harmony is dependent on our internal harmony. Which means, when does humanity have the right, when does humanity have the ability to be able to have some form of control, some form of foothold in the world around? Only when they're able to subdue themselves. Meaning, the animal kingdom will work in tandem. The world of the natural world around will work in tandem and complementarily with humanity only when humanity has forced itself to subdue itself internally. The system only works in that way. Which means, by inference, that when humanity is not doing it for the sake of being the bastion, the ambassador of God in this world, then essentially there's discord. The only time that we have that right is as long as we're doing what's correct. We're bearing that Tzelem Elokim, that image of God. When you no longer have that, when we're doing it for mere economic expansion at the severe detriment of other creations, maybe we don't bear that right anymore. Maybe we no longer have that ability anymore. It's checked by la'avda u'lashamra, to work it and to guard it. But it's more than that. Do you know what Chazal say about la'avda u'lashamra? the words to guard it, to work it and guard it. You know what they say about those words? It means, anybody familiar with what the drasha has been given on this psukim? Something which for years I never could understand in terms of its relationship to the pshat. They say la'avdo means to keep the mitzvot asay, the positive commandments, and la'shonra means to be careful of the negative commandments, mitzvot la'asay. Exactly. That's what the shamor is restraint. That's why it's the negative, restraining from the negative commandments. La'avda u l'shamra. And I always wondered that doesn't seem to be what the pasuk is saying right here. That doesn't sound. It sounds like Hashem puts him in Eden and he says, "Be careful, guard it." You know what Rav Hirsch says? The two are intrinsically connected. The two are intrinsically connected, because in the end of the day, as long as you are bearing that mission, as long as you are expressing the mission of God, then of course, then that's when you have the right and ability to work it and to guard it. But throw off that yoke, throw off that spiritual yoke, you've lost your mission. Rav Hirsch very much, and I quoted two pieces over here, but across the board, specifically in 126, describes how we only have that right. We only have that right, like the Malbim says, when there's internal harmony. That's when there's external harmony, and the world can be elevated by humankind. At this point, it is important to realize that there is a distinction, and without trying to sweep it under the carpet, there is a distinction between the animal kingdom and the natural kingdom, the organic and the inorganic world. It happens to be they're different, and really, a shear on the cruelty to animals is justified just on its own grounds. But just for the moment over here, just lumping them into one, as we'll call it, the non-human world, right? The non-human world. So what right do we have to that? Only when we have internal harmony. Only as agents of God. And agents of God comes with a few requirements, as we're going to see in a few moments. But more than this, on a Kabbalistic level, in fact, God is to be found everywhere, in every living organism, which means to say that, and as Kabbalah teaches, or within mainstream Jewish thought, is that everything is being renewed into reality on a consistent basis. That God is renewing existence, which means to say that pine tree in the middle of Siberia too is also being renewed into existence right now, because obviously there's a purpose in it in and of itself. Humanity is given the world to be able to do it, fulfill its mission with it, but it itself has something. There's something important in and of itself with that world, and therefore la'avdo l'shamra. We have to work it, we have to guard it. It's not ours. Can you think of two examples, or any example in the Torah of something which represents our lack of authority? Does humanity really own the world? So one example is Yovel and Shmita, in fact. So there are many reasons given to Yovel and Shmita. Rabbi Grunfeld actually suggests that one of the reasons for Shmita is not just in terms of bitachon, and not just in terms of... there are a number of reasons that the Chinuch gives for it, but he suggests, in fact, that the reason for Yovel and Shmita is what? Is ultimately to desist, to remind ourselves that we're on loan. Right? This is not our take home prize. More than that, there are other examples, and one of them being
the fruit trees that you can't just arbitrarily cut down.
Okay, fantastic. So we're going to come back to that in just a moment. That's actually an entire model by itself.
Dine
kashrut, how so?
Because it limits us. Well, first of all, it limits us
a lot. It does limit us. The only thing that's going to be hard to pinpoint, meaning with something like kashrut, which is often, a lot of parts of kashrut are chok, so it's going to be hard to penetrate into it and say, and understand some of the time. I have not seen anybody indicate that yet, but there's still room for that. I still think there's value in that. I'm just not sure. I have not seen anybody yet myself. The mother bird, okay. So that, you see, that's why that direction really takes us into animal cruelty. You see, that's why it differentiates from the inorganic. Right? That's a very good point as well. And there's a machloket, whether that's for us or it. Okay, so just to be aware of that. Yes.
The first exile corresponded to the number of Shemitahs.
Great. So meaning that's continuing what you just said before, is that the Shemitah was emphasized via our exile.
I'd like to
as well. What was that? Okay, so that you're thinking back to the kashrut as an example of that. I'd like to just focus on two things for a moment, and all these are very relevant. I'd just like to focus on two very quick thoughts, which are, well, number one is Shabbos. Shabbat, which is on, just if you take a look on the second page, is Rabbi Grunfeld in his book, The Sabbath, starting, this is in source 7, actually points out that, starting on the third line, we are stopped on this one day from exercising our characteristic human powers of producing. This is page 6, yellow 2. So page 6 or 7. We're in the third line. We are stopped on this one day from exercising our characteristic human powers of producing and creating in the material world. By this very inactivity, we lay these powers in homage at the feet of God who gave them. This basic Sabbath idea will be developed more fully in later chapters. If we strain our ears, however, we may even now catch what the Sabbath is trying to say to us. In fact, it says to us every week that God told the first human being. This is the Midrash in Koheles Rabbah he's quoting. I have placed you in the world of mine, this world of mine. Everything I have created is for you. Set your mind to it that you do not corrupt and destroy my world. Now, it's not a free loan. It's not a free loan. It's a gift with a mission. Moreover, and as another example, kilayim, mixing different elements within this world. In fact, the Sefer HaChinuch suggests, and without going into the side, it says that witchcraft and kilayim are very much linked, because there are certain channels of energy in the world, and should you mix those channels, you could create distraction. Meaning that God said that the world should be a certain way, and you don't have the right to go into the back room where it says. Only personnel allowed, right? That's not humanity's ability. So there is limitations in terms of our control. The world is given to us, but with a mission. But with a reminder of Shabbos that it's not ours fully. But not being able to mix different elements within the world. Very much a limited control, but yet still, notice still human-centric. Did you notice that? There wasn't an argument which was saying that humans and animals are all on the same level. Okay, just to come back to that article in the New York Times, the argument made in the New York Times was one that humanity, or in deep ecology, humanity is effectively a more aggressive species which should receive just as much as it needs, like all other species in the world. Okay, so just to be aware, we're differing. We're differing from the argument made in deep ecology, but there's still very much a check and balance in terms of our control of the world. And now I'd like to move on to the next model. This is the model found on page 7 and 8, the model of Baal Tashchis, model 2. The Torah tells us in source 9, you can see at the top of page 7, Ki sotzur el ir yomim rabim li lochem aleya, letofsa, when you will besiege a city to capture it for many days, lo sashchis hisetzol in doach alav garzen, don't cut down those trees to bring upon it a axe, because you'll eat from it. Don't cut it down. It's actually rhetorical, as most of the Farshim understand. For is the tree of the field a man that should be besieged of you? Meaning, ironically, the twist is that in battle people are being killed, but the tree is not part of that battle. The tree is not part of that battle. Now, the question we need to ask when addressing this mitzvah, the mitzvah of Baal Tashchis, the command of Baal Tashchis, is the following. Is this simply a mitzvah which bespeaks the concept, the notion of, we'll call it, economic preservation? Meaning, if something's going to be an asset to you, don't destroy it. You're going to eat from it. So just, if it's going to be something of benefit to you, don't destroy it, don't throw poison in your own water. Or is there something greater? Is there a greater sensitivity which is being demanded of us beyond the economic or beyond the monetary gain or loss that's involved? So for this, we need to look at a few halachas. And the halachas, this really is a much larger sugya. But just as an example, I brought a summary of some of the halachas of this particular din, of the Baal Tashchis. For instance, you can find in source 11, the Sifri and Devarim says that this is the law of Baal Tashchis is not simply about using an axe. The law is even cutting down a tree or destroying a tree in a way which one cuts off the irrigation system. That's interesting. Meaning, stopping the water flowing there apparently is going to be part of Baal Tashchis of destroying that tree. So the Isra extends even more than simply just using an axe. But there are a few exceptions. There are a few exceptions to this law. Number, and these can be found at the bottom of page 7. The Gemara in Baba Kama says, unless the value of the wood is greater than the value of the fruit, meaning that a person is now able to cut it down. Why? For the value, for what it's going to give him. This sounds more like it's an economic concern. So therefore, if in the cost-benefit analysis, one can come out with more money by chopping it down, one would be allowed to. That sounds more economic. However, take a look at the next one. The Gemara in Shabbos and Kuf Chav Chesam Bey says, unless the destruction is for the protection of health. Now, that sounds a little more than simply the economic value of the tree. It sounds a little more than simply preserving the use of it. Moreover, the Gemara in Shabbos on Kuf Mem Bey says, unless you have personal aesthetic preference. That's really an extreme. That means to say that the human value of doing it can even if one prefers it otherwise. The Gemara in Shabbos also says it is unless for the gratification of personal psychological need. And Tosus even says a very surprising thing, which is not a recommended thing, but in terms of the Baal Tashlis, a certain heter, unless it's an expression of anger, and therefore serves as a catharsis. Now, in this regard, the Shulchan Aruch actually doesn't pass in the laws of Baal Tashlis, it's in the Rambam. The Rambam, in three halachas, summarizes the laws of Baal Tashlis, and from this we need to draw conclusions. The Rambam says in Halacha Ches, this is in source 13, Ein kotzis in ilanei ma'achal shechutz lemedina, ve'ein moinim mehem amas ma'im kedei yavshu. So one cannot cut down fruit trees outside the country, outside of the city, and one cannot prevent the water arriving at them in order they dry up. That was the Sifri, an extension even to water irrigation. Shenei ma'lo tashches etzar, that you shouldn't destroy its wood. Kolakot etz loke, a person who cuts down will be hit, will get lashes. V'lo b'matzor bilvad, ela b'chol makom. Says the Rambam, it's not only applying simply in the state of siege, it applies in all cases. Kolakot etz ilan ma'achal derech hashchos loke, anywhere destroys fruit tree, it gets lashes. Now, a few exceptions. If it were to destroy other trees, if it is damaging to the rest of the garden, one is allowed to cut it. Or it's destroying somebody else's field. Or it's the value of chopping it down, the wood you'll get from it will be more valuable. The Torah only prohibits it in a complete wanton destructive fashion. Continues the Rambam. Kol ilan srak mutar lo kutzosav afilo en sarichla. A person is able to cut down a non-fruit bearing tree for less of a reason. If a tree is not producing sufficiently that's worth the bother. So you see the limitations of the halacha are not so simple. And he gives the shear. And now the Rambam extends this, or makes an important extension. That is, v'lo ha'ilanas bilvad, ela kol ha'meshaber kelim v'korea begodim v'horez binyan v'soser ma'ayan ma'abed ma'achalos derech hashchasa over b'lo tashchis. If a person is going to be destroying not even just a fruit tree, but let's say your possessions, your clothes, your buildings, blocking up a spring, anything, destroying food, that's all Baal Tashchis. But there's only in this case, being as it is an extension midrabanon of the particular love, therefore there is only makos marjus, which is rabbinic lashes. So it's an interesting and complex subject to the law of Baal Tashchis. There's a lot of thought that needs to be invested in this. In fact, the Shulchan Aruch Rav, when paskening this particular area, says that Baal Tashchis even applies to the property of hefker. It even applies to something which is ownerless, very clearly pointing in the direction that this is not something which is about necessarily just economic preservation, but something greater, something perhaps leaving what would we call the realm of mammon, of monetary concern, to isur v'heter, to what we'll call religious law. Isur v'heter, that a person is obligated to think about carefully, and in fact, that's why when the Sefer HaChinuch, when addressing the reason, potential reason behind this mitzvah, points out, this is back on source, in source 10 on page 7, points out that really A person is supposed to gain an appreciation for everything that God created. And he uses the language on the third line, "V'lo yavdu afilu gargir shel chardol ba'olam." A person should not even destroy one mustard seed. Ad kedei kach, says the Sefer HaChinuch, that one has to have an appreciation of every small aspect of creation, because God wants it to be that way. And that's the essence of this mitzvah. Yes, there are exceptions. Yes, there are times where there are mitigating circumstances. However, at the end of the day, what we're supposed to be getting out of this is a deep sense of appreciation. But let's just stop for a moment here after these two models and notice something very fascinating. Both Model 1 and both Model 2 accept the fact that humanity is able to use the world around it. Humanity is not on the same level of the world as the world around them. However, there is a limit. There is an appreciation that it's on loan, as you saw in the first model. There's an appreciation that for particular human usage, it would be all right to cut down a tree. But nevertheless, the value, there are two values at tension over here. And over here you see, well, by the way, how Judaism differs within these two models from all the environmental principles which are being portrayed today. If we went back to that article in the New York Times, one of the things that is mentioned is that Christianity should stop putting an emphasis on having many children. That humanity is different to animals. Now, those aspects, although we may have an appreciation of the environment, Judaism does not embrace that. Judaism does not embrace the fact that humanity is on the same level as animals. I heard a story that Rabbi Tatz was once on a plane, and on the plane he was sitting next to somebody else, and the lady noticed that he had a special meal, and it was a kosher meal, and she also had a special meal, so she commented about his meal, and he said, "Oh, I see you also got one." He said, "Yeah, I have a vegetarian meal. I don't believe in eating other animals." So Rabbi Tatz turned to her and says, "Why not? They do." But there is a notion out there which is that effectively humanity really should be on the same level, and therefore is a more aggressive species exerting its power needs to be equalized. That Judaism does not accept. However, within the hierarchy of humans and humans being able to elevate the rest of the world around them, there are checks and balances. But the problem is that at this point, if we just stop, it would be hard to draw that line. So what about offshore drilling? What about when it comes to earning money? Do you say that now, because it comes to earning money and capitalism, now that would now allow, because after all it is for human benefit, that would allow unbridled, or let's say if it's not going to, in the realm of Baal Tashchis, it'll be like the tree which is value of the wood is greater than the value of the fruit. So where do you draw the line? Are you allowed to just use anything because after all humanity is benefiting? That's the problem. This is why it becomes hazy. For this, I'd like to introduce the last model, which I think adds a completely different perspective to what we've seen up till now, and this is something very relevant to society today. This idea I saw quoted by Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the son of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, in the name of his father, who pointed to the second perek of Bava Basra. The second perek of Bava Basra talks about what we call Hilchos Shcheinim, the laws of neighbors. And I'd like to read to you a number of fascinating halachas which are found there. For instance, let's take a look on, this is on the last double-sided page, 9 and 10, source 16. Mishneh Gimel. Lo yiftach adam chanos shel naftam v'shel tzavoyim tachas otzara shel chavere v'lo yerefes bakar. A person should open a bakery, or a dyeing factory, or even a cattle stall underneath the otzar, the storehouse of one's friend, because these are all things which have a certain odor, a certain odor or smell, which is going to obviously rise, and therefore having a strong smelling business underneath somebody else's storehouse is inevitably going to affect them, even though you're operating totally within your own property. Mishneh Ches. You need the distance, a fixed granary, this is a larger granary, from the city, 50 amos, 50 cubits. Lo yaseh adam goren kavo b'sosh lo, elohim ken yesh lo 50 amos lo kol ruach. And you can also not open up a fixed granary in your own property unless you have sufficient distance to your neighbors. Moving on to Mishnah Test. You have to distance carcasses of animals, burial places, and tanneries, which all things which have the potential to smell terrible, from these that you distance from the city 50 amos. 50 amos. Enos in Burski, ela le mizrach ha'ir. And you can only make the tannery on the east side of the city. This is for more spiritual reasons, as the Gemara goes on to explain. And finally, in Mishnah Yudalad, Elan Shehu Notzilu Shusarabim, a tree which is in your property, leaning over into the public domain. Kotzetz Kadeshia Gamal Over Verochba. You need to cut sufficiently that a camel and its rider can go underneath it without being caught. And in our language, we're talking about a double-decker bus or something, or some means of transport. Now, these Mishnayos are very interesting because they're not talking about the issur of damaging, per se. This is not talking about a person lighting a fire, talking about a person opening up a pit in the public domain, about having his animal going into somebody else's property. What we are talking about over here is somebody doing something within their own property, but somehow in their own private backyard, there can be an effect on neighbors. And these Mishnayos put an issur on this. But where does this come from? Where do the rabbis see fit that such a thing should be asur? So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik points to two of the early Rishonim, the medieval commentators on this Gemara, on these Mishnayos. One is the Tshuvas HaRosh in Klal Kufches, who points out in Source 17 that it, at essence, at the very basis, the basis of this is Ki Derachea Darcheinu Am V'Chol Nesiv Asei Hashalom. The Torah, its ways are nice, and its paths are peaceful. And therefore the Torah says that in a Torah society, you should not be doing something in your own property which will effectively cause damage to others. Similarly, the Yad Ramah, who I'm on that Gemara in Baba Basra, it also says in Source 18, that it is either from the negative of Lifnei Iver Lo Titen Michshol, that you shouldn't be causing stumbling blocks to others, even if it's in your own property, or V'Ahavta L'Rayecha Kamocha, or loving one's neighbor as oneself, one's friend as oneself. And this means to say that there are general mitzvahs which encompass so much, and the Rabbanon extended it. The rabbis extended it to specific examples of how careful one has to be. And what's interesting about this is that when you're dealing with a small village or two neighbors, then there are certain halachas, 50 amos for a granary. What about, you know, a burski, a tannery? Those are the things at hand in those generations. But think about today for a second. In today's day and age, they're much worse, they're much more terrifying things which need to be distanced. The factories and the pollution rates in water, in air, take California for example, are skyrocketing. The effect which large factories, the effect of individuals on one another is in the urban village which we live today, is much more terrifying and requires many more checks. Just as an example, this is something unfortunately resolved pretty recently, is leaded petrol, leaded gas. Leaded gas was introduced over 80 years ago when it was found that adding lead to gas would stop a knocking noise in the engine. There were no experiments conducted at the beginning of its usage as to its effects on humanity. And later on, the company which primarily produced leaded gas, Ethyl, did do some studies, and I'd just like to turn your attention to page 10, in the second paragraph. In one such study, a doctor who had no specialized training in chemical pathology undertook a 5-year program in which volunteers were asked to breathe in or swallow lead in elevated quantities. Then their urine and feces were tested. Unfortunately, as the doctor appears not to have known, lead is not excreted as a waste product. Rather, it accumulates in the bones and blood. That's what makes it so dangerous. And neither bone nor blood was tested. In consequence, lead was given a clean bill of health. The person who fought against this almost lost his job and lost his research money, Patterson, who was the person instrumental in finally banning leaded petrol up to only recently. And in fact, lead was only removed from food containers in the 90s in America. In some countries, still leaded gas is still being used and sold by that same company. To his great credit, this is the next paragraph, Patterson never wavered nor buckled. Eventually, his efforts led to the introduction of the Clean Air Act in 1917, and finally the removal from sale of all leaded gasoline in the United States in 1986. Almost immediately, lead levels in the blood of Americans fell by 80%, but because lead is forever, those of us alive today have about 625 times more lead in our blood than people did a century ago. That's simply by driving a car with leaded gas. Hilchus Shchenim has become exceptionally complicated in today's day and age. So even without having to look at the model of humanity at the hierarchy to be able to use and elevate the world with the mission, their mission, as their God-given mission, with the checks and balances to that control, there's another factor which has become so much more relevant. What about your neighbors? What about the way it affects the people around you? And there's no such thing as an action which doesn't affect others these days. In what's happening today, everything has an effect. These are some thoughts. This is certainly not a comprehensive study, but three models of approaching and understanding Judaism and its particular approach and some of the ideas that Judaism has to share about the relevant concepts of environmentalism today. Thank you very much.